for we knew, as men in the line, that something was afoot.
But I learned from a fellow sergeant, who I suspected was the intelligence sergeant of our field ambulance. He said to me, look, he says, there was a prisoners of war camp close to us, German prisoners of war. And it came into me one day, he says, there must be something going. He says, all those prisoners of war have been suddenly rounded up, marched off, and they're being shipped to England. He says, there's something coming along.
Spring 1918. Over the next few months, the outcome of the war would be decided, one way or another. Russia had been defeated. France was nearing breaking point. Britain was battered by battlefield losses and counting the cost of holding up the Allied cause. Leaders cast nervous glances at the home front and on industrial unrest. America was slowly shipping men across the Atlantic, but would they arrive in time to make a difference? Germany knew it had a chance to win the war. If it could send its veterans from the Eastern Front to win in the West before the Americans tipped the balance. William Collins of the Cavalry Field Ambulance was in the area of the Somme in March 1918.
We gradually moved forward towards the front line. On the 19th of March, we were about 10 miles behind the front line. On the 20th, we were about 6 miles behind the front line.
We could hear the noise of the transports, and we could hear the Germans cursing and swearing, and we knew that there was heavy transport movements, movements of guns, lorries and men in the rear, and it brought great foreboding to all of us.
After a few months of relative quiet on the Western Front over the winter, it dawned on Private C.A. Kane that something was coming.
There was an eerie feeling because of a continuous low whistle which went on and on right through the night. And I made my way to company headquarters about 400 yards to the rear and saw the company commander and told him, I said, look, Jerry will be over in the morning. He's cut all his wire. He's all ready for it. Now, can we get back to those lines of trenches that we've been busy digging for the last 3 weeks, 400 yards back? He said, my instructions are, Kane, stand to your post to the last. Sell your life as dearly as possible. Now, this sounds all right when you read it in a book, but when you're facing what we now know to be an overwhelming force of enemy, poised ready to pounce, and you get an order like that, it's curtains. And it's an order which, in point of fact, I didn't carry out, or I wouldn't be here.
A massive onslaught against Allied forces was underway. It was the Kaiserschlacht, the Kaiser's battle, and its opening move, Operation Michael, was a stunning blow on British forces amid the wastelands left behind after the Battle of the Somme.
That morning, you couldn't see 5 yards. It was a hell of a mist.
We knew that there we were, probably facing the biggest fight of our lives, the battle which might wipe us all out.
We fired as much as possible until the infantry came to us and they said the Germans was coming. And actually, I thought it was the end of the war, as far as we were concerned. I got into a gun pit which we made, and the Germans started shelling us again. And I did pray on my knees in that gun pit.
Germany believed it could win the war now, in the spring of 1918. It was a desperate gamble to defeat an enemy that was getting stronger every day. The German objective was to smash a hole in the Allied front, divide the British from the French and reach the Channel, then push the British into the sea and cut off their supplies, on which the French war effort depended. To make this happen, 500,000 battle-hardened veterans from the Eastern Front were sent into battle in the West. The weather played into German hands that morning on the 21st of March. Thick fog carpeted the ground, which left British soldiers on the front line struggling to sense what was going on.
the Germans appeared suddenly from dead ground in front of us. It was a badly positioned trench, as a matter of fact, and drove straight at us with their bayonets fixed and their rifles going and so on. And we fell back.
The German hardware was formidable. More than 6,000 guns and 3,000 heavy trench mortars had been deployed. The 3rd and 5th armies couldn't possibly hold onto their front lines. Private George Thompson and his comrades retreated, then dug in.
Before daylight, we retreated still further. And then just about dawn, we retreated again. And this time, we retreated most of the day. You lay down on the ground, and then when the enemy appeared in sight, you opened fire on them. But that drove them down, you know, onto the ground again. And then you got up and you retreated. Then you stopped again and you held them a bit and retreated. Went on all day.
The Allies were losing ground hour by hour. Sergeant Joe Fitzpatrick was manning a Lewis gun in the support trench when a terrifying realisation set in that the Germans had infiltrated their lines from both sides.
I shouted, "Gas, gas!" And go on, I said, "Get ready." And two officers came along, and I think they were drunk as lords myself, because they were waving their revolvers and singing, "Here's the Bosch, here's the Bosch, the Bosch is here." And so I'm swooping down the valley. I run back and I come round this crater, see, and got behind my Lewis gun team, and I'm saying, "Keep the bastard there, keep him there."
The sergeant major said to me, "But we can't stay here, because there was nobody left alive down that road." He said, "We'll have to retire, we'll have to get back."
Walter Hare, with the West Yorkshire Regiment, was among the small parties of men ordered to cover the retreat in holding actions.
So he said, "After the next burst of gunfire, we'll dash for it." And there was a burst of fire, and the sergeant major ran, and I saw him fall down in the field behind us. So I thought, "I'd better wait until it's a bit darker, and then I'll try to get away." But I was too late. By that time, they were around us, they surrounded us, and they were coming from behind. Germans in front, the Germans at the side, and the Germans behind. I put my hands up and dropped my gun. That's all you can do in a case like that.
For all the mayhem, the British knew that they had to at least attempt to send reserve units in to counterattack. In the thick of it, 2nd Lieutenant Cyril Dennis, with the Royal Garrison Artillery, was firing shells into the Germans.
They were quite big shells, of course, ours. And we had one battery with two very big ones, 8-inch. And I could see large bursts of smoke and debris and that. And then a gratifying absence of human activity. I hoped that I had got them. I was in a mood that I very seldom found myself in the war, and that was I was really feeling rather vindictive.
But the German advance was unstoppable. Anyone with a view of the front line could see the only possible course of action. Retreat. William Collins was with the cavalry field ambulance.
After dusk, all the casualties we got away, and of course the order was given to retire to the fighting troops, and we went back, and we were going back every day for 8 days, going back a bit.
Advances that had been measured in metres now stretched for miles on end. The British yielded nearly 40 miles of territory, the biggest retreat since 1914. So much ground, won with such blood and sweat, given up in less than a fortnight. A few days later, William Collins had retreated as far back as Le Hamel, over the River Somme.
Those that did stop and fight, most of them became casualties, and some of them prisoners. This retreat was bombed unmercilessly by night, by the German night bombers. That they bombed the roads mercilessly. Every known source of retreat but was bombed.
Joe Pickard was caught in a box barrage of German shells on the 31st of March. German artillery simply saturated a particular piece of ground to stop anyone moving on it. Next thing he knew, he was lying in the road alongside piles of dead soldiers. Shrapnel had cut his sciatic nerve, smashed his bladder, and his nose was gone. Somehow, he made it to a Red Cross van.
I remember being in this sort of advanced clearance station. When I came home, it was dark. And I was lying in a on the stretcher. It turned out there was a blanket over the top of us. I was left for dead.
Good.
The old lady got the number of my grave. King and Queen sympathy.
You were reported as dead then?
Yeah.
For William Collins too, it was almost the end of the war.
Having a breather in between bandaging the casualties, I went to a bank and I sat down with my back to the bank and my head back. I got my tin hat on, having a rest, you see. But the shell came and blew me out. I was blown unconscious. How long I was unconscious, I don't know. It must have been about 2 or 3 hours, because when I came to, I got up, walked out, and I looked at the other end of the bank. They dug themselves into slit trenches all while I was unconscious. And I stood there looking down at them. I was obviously nutty. I was off my head, you know. My tin hat had been forced down on my head, and I was badly concussed, and I was wounded round the back of the neck. My coat was all torn ragged by the bits of shell. And all of a sudden, a stream of machine gun bullets came by. I've never heard a more horrifying sound in my life. It was like 1,000 gas taps turned on. You know, oh, but that magnified about 100 times. Going past, hissing past. I couldn't barely hear a sound. I couldn't barely hear a pin drop, you know, after that damage to my head. And in 3 weeks, I lost nearly all my hair. In 3 weeks, that was the hammer for me.
Even for those lucky enough to survive without injuries, many, like Private Walter Hare, now found themselves prisoners of war, battling the elements, almost as hard as they'd fought the enemy.
When we could sleep, we tried to sleep, but we didn't get much. And each night, of course, there were some of the chaps couldn't stand it. They died of exposure. And you see, they gave us nothing to eat for 3 days. And we tried to dig ourselves a little grove in the ground, but it's all filled with water, so you thought you were better on top. And my brother and I used to try to keep together. But the guard used to come in on the morning and look around to see if there was any who died during the night, pick them up, take them out. And they dug a long sort of trench at the side of the wire cage, and each morning the dead were thrown in there.
But for all the grim suffering of those March days, Operation Michael was not a victory for the Germans. The British line had bent, but not broken. At massive cost to themselves, the Germans had gained a 40-mile-deep salient, but failed to reach the rail junction at Amiens, and had failed to divide the British and French allies. British, French and Australian units eventually managed to plug the gaps in the line. Over 150,000 British soldiers were killed, wounded or captured. The survivors had stared defeat in the face. And for many soldiers, that was the cruelest prospect of all.
When the Germans broke through like that, I thought, after 4 years against them, that we had lost the war, this is the end. After all the lives had been sacrificed.
I'm more or less sorry for them. I'm more or less bloody sorry for them. See? They were being sacrificed, in a sense of speaking.